Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Modo Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Modo Casino, the only app worth your time.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations. With two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about suspicious sections and precarious pregnancies. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of Justin Arthur and Matthew Harrison are voice talents Olivia Steele, Kevin Barberi, Justine Anastasia, Nick Goroff, Jeff Sturdivant, and Eric Peabody. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our Theater of the Minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by Justin Arthur and performed by Olivia Steele and Kevin Barberi. In it, we meet Madeline, a woman who moves into the countryside HUD house her husband Travis had managed to find while she was gone. The house is old, worn, and isolated, but what catches her eye most is the section of wall that her husband had covered up. Now, without further ado, I present to you the dumbwaiter.
As she parked her Corolla, looking up at the old weathered house looming above her, Madeline wondered if she should have taken up her friend's offer to smudge it with sage. The two-story construction had been a lucky find scouring HUD listings, at least according to her husband. She had let him be in charge of house hunting while she had been busy in Minnesota helping her sister. She had been having trouble taking care of her family while her own husband had been in the hospital. But now that he was able to help again, Madeline wasn't worried for them anymore. 2 months and two state lines later, here she was at what was going to be her home. And goodness, should she have been involved. The price had been right, and per the inspections, the house was safe. But everything about it felt worn and rough, nestled next to the rocky hillside and surrounded by struggling patches of scrub emerging from the gravel where they could. She trusted Travis, but she definitely should have been there. At least everything was already moved in. She pulled out her cell phone, checking the messages as best she could despite the spotty signal this far outside of St. Louis. Following the instructions, she found the key hidden to the right of the front door and opened her way inside, taking in the smell of dust, wood, and age wafting out from the tiled foyer. She moved inside with her travel bags and quickly locked the door before looking over her surroundings. The foyer connected to a living room on the right, a staircase to the bedrooms on the left, and a tight hallway that led to the kitchen ahead of her. She wandered through the living room. Travis had done his best to set everything up, but by the time he returned from his own business trip, she would have this place in the state it should be. A knock on the door broke her out of her trance, making her jump. Who on earth would be knocking on the door of a formerly abandoned country house half an hour away from the closest big city? She looked out a window to investigate, spotting a lanky young man with a loaded hiking backpack. She moved to the front door, making sure the chain was on before cracking it open. "Hello?" she asked.
"Oh, hi, ma'am. I'm Jason Foster. I spoke to your husband a few weeks back about doing some research on his property."
He brought up his cell phone, showing a picture of him standing next to her husband.
"Mr. Dillon said it would be okay, but I wanted to check with you as well."
She undid the chain, opening the door wider. This dorky little college kid looked like a strong breeze would blow him away. "Oh, what kind of research?"
"Oh, I'm studying a local species of tritons."
He plopped down his backpack and shuffled through it.
"Newts. There appears to be a species on your property and those surrounding that has not been discovered, or at least not fully researched. You and Mr. Dillon are the first owners I've been able to track down. I promise I won't get in the way. I'll just be down by the streams that flow through the hills."
He unearthed some pictures, hoisting them up to reveal shots of gray, slimy amphibians as lanky as he was. She had thought newts to be colorful creatures, but these looked drab and lifeless, the only distinct break from the gray being two giant black spots that must be their eyes. They reminded her of deep-sea creatures. Ugh, she was going to have to deal with seeing these things as well.
"Don't worry, I've only located them down by the streams,"
he said.
"Is it okay if I continue my research? I haven't been able to get far. The specimens I find are just Fs, little babies that keep dying. I think they're flowing from somewhere further upstream."
"It's okay," she said. "If it's okay, though, I just got home."
"Oh, of course. Bye, Mrs. Del..."
She shut the door, struggling enough to cope with everything that's changed, all while her husband was off working. Thankfully, someone she had been looking forward to seeing came from upstairs to welcome her. "Hey, Jester!" she called out, smiling as the gray tabby sauntered his way down the steps and sat right before her. He meowed loudly before getting back up, rubbing himself on her and proceeding to meow again. He had been alone for a day or two and wasn't afraid to let her know his thoughts on it. She gave him some head scratches and he purred. "You've been keeping the place safe while your humans were gone?" He chirped and moved away from her hand, heading down the hallway to the kitchen and looking back at her to make sure she was following. She obliged, smirking at the cat trying to lead her to his empty food bowl. But instead of continuing into the kitchen, he stopped at the end of the hall and looked up at a spot on the wall that would be just past the staircase. He got his paws up on the wall, looking upward and hissing before looking back at her. He let out the warning meow he gave to other cats and small children. "It's a wall, Jester," she said. "Weird little cat." As she got closer, though, she thought she could see something. She got next to Jester, who moved out of the way, as she ran her fingers across the surface, sensing a slight gap that had been covered over with paper and painted. Her fingers trailed around it, tracing the gap in a large square before stepping back and shuddering. Madeline dumped a can of food into Jester's bowl, the cat scarfing the meal down at top speed while she punched numbers into her phone. Eventually, she reached Travis.
"Hey, love,"
he said.
"Everything okay? You get settled in?"
"Hey, Travis," she said. "Just looking around the house, and there's a gap in the wall."
"Oh, I totally blanked on that. This house used to have a dumbwaiter, but they sealed it when they closed off the root cellar and remodeled the second floor. It has been used in decades. I had just painted it over myself so it didn't stick out or risk someone getting hurt messing with it."
"I really need to be part of the process when we go house hunting," she said. "But it's sealed off?"
"Totally closed down. There isn't even a way to work it. I'm sorry I didn't tell you about this, Maddie. There's been so much going on lately."
"It's fine," she said. "Your business trip can't be finished soon enough. I don't want to be here alone."
"You have Jester, at least. That cat attacked a dog 4 times his own size. He'll keep you safe."
"Okay, I'll be fine." She was broken out of her rest by Jester jumping on her in the dead of night. She sat up, rubbing the sleep out of her eyes before grabbing her glasses. Jester wandered around the bed, looking back at her. He always woke her up because Travis could sleep through a gas main exploding outside.
"What is it?" she asked.
"It's nowhere near time for your breakfast, you stupid cat." Thump. The room grew colder than it already was as she heard something come from downstairs. She threw the covers back, almost launching Jester off the bed with them as she got out and into her slippers. She reached under her husband's side of the bed and grabbed the baseball bat he kept for precisely this situation. Thump. She could feel it right beneath her, one floor below. Thump. Thump, 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 thump. Small footsteps, almost like when they had heard animals scurrying in the walls of their previous apartment. But that wasn't it either. These were much bigger. Yet they moved so quickly, so many rapid steps in quick succession. Was the burglar scuffling around? Or was it a particularly large rat? Meanwhile, her mighty hunter was upstairs with her instead of taking care of the intruder. She made her way out of the bedroom, listening again as she heard more of the rapid footsteps. It was in the kitchen now, stamping near the cabinets. She gulped, checking for her phone before realizing she left it downstairs in the corner of the living room she was turning into her workspace. Even if she had her phone, she'd be lucky if the police got here in time. She moved down the staircase, choosing each step and putting as little pressure on the center as she could to avoid any creaks or groans. As she got lower, she saw into the foyer, the front door wide open, with a breeze blowing in from the pitch blackness. She could feel her hair standing up as she moved into the room, her valiant companion hot on her heels and puffed up like a furry feather duster. He stopped at the beginning of the hallway to the kitchen, arching back and hissing as she looked straight ahead and turned on the light. Nothing. Nothing in the kitchen. She stepped ahead, moving in and looking around the space, then going into the living room from where it connected to the kitchen. Nothing. No evidence that anything had even been disturbed. She went back to the kitchen but still couldn't find anything. Not so much as one dish had been misplaced, not a single mark of dirt on the floor from whoever had come from outside. She returned to the foyer, spotting Jester standing guard in the center of the room. He looked up at her, still puffed up like he had gotten an electric shock.
"I guess they left, buddy," she said. "I must have forgotten to lock the front door."
She shut it and made sure the deadbolt and chain were on before turning off the light again. The rapid thumping came back, this time from above. Jester yelped and took off like a bullet, vanishing upstairs as the constant footsteps moved between the bedrooms. She froze. What was going on? How had it gotten upstairs without her knowing?
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
She turned the light back on, and the thumping stopped, somewhere in the room above the living room where it connected to the kitchen. The bat shook in her hands as she looked around, noticing something different in the kitchen hall. The paper that had covered the dumbwaiter had been torn off, lying in strips on the wooden flooring. That's how this burglar had done it. It had to be a burglar if he could figure out a dumbwaiter was there and use it to get upstairs without her noticing. He must have used it to get onto the second floor. Why was he being so sneaky, though? She kept the light on, the dim bulb not doing as much to assuage her as she had hoped. She heard the rapid thumps again as the burglar scuffled his way through their bedroom and what was to be her husband's office. Jester had run upstairs, but she couldn't hear him. She'd have thought he would be busy attacking the intruder with as much fury as a small cat could muster. She moved up the steps, eschewing silence for speed so she could catch the bastard in the act. Her heart beat louder than the creaking stairs as she flew up, bat at the ready to maim the burglar so she could bind him and have the police at the front door as fast as possible. She launched up several stairs at a time, the thumps coming to a stop, and arrived on the second floor.
She barged into Travis's office, weapon at the ready. Nothing. An empty room, an untouched desk without so much as a single thing misplaced. Even the ugly statue of the googly-eyed monster from those dark RPGs he liked to play still stood watch over his possessions. She spotted Jester hiding under his desk, his gray fur not helping him blend in. He let out a pitiful meow. The thumps returned. She jumped. How on earth could it be downstairs again? There was no way. She moved back to the second floor landing and checked the section of wall that should have had the dumbwaiter. But there was nothing. No scraps of paper, no slight depression. The dumbwaiter had never gone to the second floor. The burglar had gotten past her twice without using it. Had he opened a window and climbed outside? But she had locked the door. Had she locked all the windows? But then why had the paper around the dumbwaiter been torn? Rapid thumps again in the kitchen. She heard the refrigerator door open and a loud, wet slap as something was pulled out and onto the floor. Then more crashes as the rest of the contents of the fridge were yanked free with uncaring hurry. She still trembled, but after being led up and down these stairs, the thought of slamming the bat into some vagrant grew more and more appealing. She rushed down the stairs, made the turn into the kitchen hallway so fast she nearly slipped, and sailed past the dumbwaiter, bat ready. To nothing but a mess of food on the floor, the fridge door swinging in the cold air. She froze. This couldn't be possible. It was just here. She had heard it making all that noise, yet it was nowhere to be seen. It hadn't opened any windows, had it? She moved over to the fridge, shutting it. And as she did, she felt a sickening squish under her hand. She looked at the handle of the fridge door. It was covered in a thick, viscous slime. She stepped back, her hand growing cold and almost tingly as she wiped off the slime on a kitchen towel. She could still move her fingers, but her entire hand felt numb, like she'd fallen asleep on her arm. What was going on? What could even do this? She heard a creak at the front door and had to shake herself free of her trance, forcing her steps out back into the hallway to look into the foyer. The chain had been left on the door, but the deadbolt had been moved back. The door opened to the darkness yet again. The trembling came back, nothing making sense to her as she did her best to hold her bat in her hand that wasn't going numb. She re-entered the foyer yet again, but before she could shut the door, she looked at it. The knob and the lock for the deadbolt now glistened with a layer of the same mucus that had been on the fridge door's handle. She pushed it shut in a dry area, racking her mind as she looked around. Then she noticed something in the living room. Nothing stood out of place, but a section that had previously been lit had been darkened, a shadow cast from the light of the foyer's bulb. She stepped to the threshold between the foyer and living room, looking at the shadow, feeling a bulge grow in her throat. Gripping her bat as tightly as she could, she traced where the shadow was coming from. Whatever was blocking the light had to be on the ceiling. She forced herself to turn around, but before she had made it all the way, she saw the form that had blocked the light dart off, back down the hallway, accompanied by the rapid thumps as it crawled across the ceiling. Her heart sped up again as she tried to put the pieces together, still nothing making sense. She moved back into the foyer and looked up at where it had been, a glistening trail of mucus that she would have completely missed had she not known to look for it, a thin sheen that would have dried out and vanished before morning. She followed the trail with her eyes back into the kitchen. She moved down the hallway, each step making her wish the nightmare would end and she'd wake up with Jester sitting on her chest demanding breakfast. She stepped into the kitchen, spotting no shadow on either side of the room. She stopped, quieting herself as best she could, listening for something, anything. In the silence, not even disturbed by the usual nightly chorus, she heard a frenetic breathing just to her right. She leaped out into the kitchen and screamed as she swung her bat at the corner of the ceiling, then yelped and darted back before she could follow through. A glistening, 6-foot monstrosity glared back at her before darting across the room, its tiny legs moving so fast it was like its streamlined gray body was flowing past the light. She recovered enough to get to the living room entrance it had been going for, landing a hit on its back with the bat as it tried to clear the doorway. The nasty thing landed on the floor in front of her, but was back on its feet before she could get herself to strike it again, its rapid footsteps carrying it across the floor to the living room and up the wall. It stopped, facing its head toward her with 2 massive black dots cutting across its smooth face, a lipless mouth opening wide. It had a ridge of tiny fangs on the edge of its mouth, but her skin crawled as she saw columns of cluster teeth lining its palate and trailing all the way to the back of its throat. She yelped as it charged at her, and she brought the bat down, hitting its head with a loud crunch. She hit it again and again, screaming as she bashed and battered her assailant until its head had been caved in, dark blood leaking across the floor. It twitched in death as she stepped back, her numb hand growing colder. She couldn't feel her fingers anymore. She was grabbing Jester and getting them both out of here. She turned her focus back to the door and saw it had been opened again. She hadn't locked the deadbolt, as it had been covered in more of that numbing slime. Her eyes bulged as another one of those hideous things darted into the foyer from outside, the tail of a raccoon sticking out of its mouth as the rest made its way down its gullet. It shot to the nearest wall and crawled up, followed by another one of the things from outside that went up across from the first. A third came in from the blackness as well, staying on the floor just long enough to push the door shut with its head. Madeline stepped back into the living room, holding the bat with one hand as the other had completely become useless. The 3 things watched her, and as she stepped back, she saw the wooden section over the dumbwaiter pop open, creaking wide as another one of the nasty, slimy creatures shot out onto the wall. They hadn't come from outside, trying to get to the dumbwaiter. They had already been inside. She let out one last scream as all 4 barreled toward her. As the sun made its way further up the horizon, Jason pondered the flow of water making its way out of the hillside. This stream had been particularly fruitful for his research, but still he was only finding Fs of the species of Triton, and half-dead ones at that. The gray skin, the large eyes, this must be some sort of subterranean variety. Foster's Triton discovered by an up-and-coming student at UMSL. Maybe their school mascot would get a gray counterpart. If only he could get further upstream, but the water came from within the hillside. He needed to figure out a way to access the caves within. That had to be their natural territory. He thought it over. Mrs. Dellen seemed wary of him, but maybe he could win her over. A surprising number of houses in Missouri were connected to caves underneath them that were once used for storage. Maybe she'd let him in so he could try there? It was that, or he'd have to break into one of the abandoned houses nearby and hope they had something. She had been home when he arrived in the early morning. He had even seen an adorable gray tabby pawing at the window and had instantly wanted to pet it. He'd swing by, knock, and ask if she knew anything about the caves. Before he could get up, though, something new flowed out of the stream from within the mountain. Something that made him jump back. A torn, ragged nightshirt, covered in viscous slime and stained with blood.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
I hope you enjoyed The Dumb Waiter, as written by Justin Arthur, and performed by Olivia Steele and Kevin Barberi. Our second tale of the evening is written by Matthew Harrison and performed by Justine Anastasia, Kevin Barberi, Nick Goroff, Jeff Sturtevant, and Eric Peabody. In it, we'll bear witness to a woman lied to, a doctor full of regrets, and a child that will curse the world. Now, without further ado, I present to you, Are You Expecting?
May 27th, 2030, 10:30 a.m. to 10:35 a.m. The hum of fluorescent lights, the smell of antiseptic, and the squeaking of chairs as men in white lab coats rolled around the porcelain floors created an image of sickness in Abigail's mind. This was not what she had expected when she and her husband Tom came in for her appointment today. People in suits had rushed her down the elevator and told her to change into this hospital gown in such a hurry that she thought something was wrong. Now, as she listens to the heartbeat monitor they attached to her, she thinks she can hear the beeps increasing. "How much longer?" she asks the man closest to her. He looks up from his clipboard and lets out the kind of smile a politician gives when they're bullshitting.
"Not much longer. Blood results should be back shortly."
"Can I see Tom at least?"
"He's right there."
He points to the one-way mirror. Abigail waves a small wave, hoping Tom is there and not with those men in suits. "Can I stand up for a little at least? My legs are getting numb, doctor."
"I'm not a doctor, ma'am, but sure, go ahead."
There were a lot of not doctors making decisions for her lately. She sat up, the weight in her stomach ballooning more and more each day. Hell, hour by hour now, making it impossible to lie down on her back with any semblance of comfort. Sitting up from a laying position has become a Herculean task, and the heart rate monitor shows it, jumping from 70 BPM to 95 BPM. She stands on her sore feet, heavy and swollen like a brick. She puts her hand to her forehead to control the dizzy spells she gets whenever she does get up. Did the fact that she was having twins make all these symptoms worse? The people who had given her the IVF injection said their new treatment might cause a more intense pregnancy, but lately, Abigail thought they undersold that statement. This was a pregnancy on steroids. The only benefit, outside of finally conceiving, is the shortened time frame. Deliver the baby in half the time, the initial trial coordinator had told her and Tom. Less time she needed to be an incubator is what made her agree, along with the assurance of safety. These are the final steps of this new treatment, the same coordinator had told them. The first few weeks after the treatment weren't too bad. The regular symptoms of tiredness and nausea had set in, plus Tom was so happy, she sucked it up. After years of trying and thousands of dollars on other forms of treatment that went nowhere, money that could have gone to a down payment on a house, they were on their way to start the family he always wanted. When they told her at the first ultrasound that it would be twins, Tom's excitement doubled, while her apprehension, fear, tripled. She looks at her reflection in the mirror again. Her stomach protrudes out like a pale, peach-colored balloon, with rotten veins running across the circumference. All this in 3 months, she thinks. Abigail bends over to a crashing pain, a punch on the inside of her stomach. Grasping at the swelling in her middle, the flesh below her gut curls in and then out like a wave rolling, a familiar feeling these past weeks. "Ugh!" she exclaims, then sits back down. She reaches for a bottle of water, but her clammy fingers fumble with it, sending it off the desk onto the floor. Another wave of pain ripples from her belly button to her spine, as though the space between the two is collapsing. She tries to say, "Oh God." "Ah!" comes out instead.
"Let me get that for you,"
the not a doctor says, grabbing the water, unscrewing it and handing it to her. "Thanks," she says in a breathless voice. She puts the water to her lips. She needs to go home, take a bath, and let this wave of pain blow over. Can I leave soon? Babies aren't due for another month, according to the doctor. But you guys are acting like it's going to pop out now.
Soon, very soon. We have to check a few things.
Abigail looks around. She hadn't noticed that the other men in lab coats had left the room. It's just her and this not-a-doctor alone. Where did everyone go?
Out. Do you mind lying back down? I need to get a final read before we can send you off.
Abigail does so, feeling more and more like a slab of meat. The sound of her heartbeat bouncing off the steel bed makes a thunk, thunk, thunk sound that matches the beep, beep, beep of the heart rate monitor. She closes her eyes, envisioning a time when she will be at home, her stomach and life back to normal. Clank. Something snaps near her hands. She opens her eyes to see two metal bracelets squeezing her wrist.
Hey! What?
She tries to speak, but a wave of pain all through her lower half interrupts her. It was not a punch, not anything she had felt during the entirety of this pregnancy, as though the babies were eating her from the inside. She screams.
Try and relax. It will all be over soon.
Abigail looks at her stomach. The skin is starting to press forward.
What's going on?
It will be over soon.
May 20th, 2035, 9 p.m. to 9:16 p.m. Dr. Jeremiah Stewart sits down at his cubicle desk with his seventh cup of coffee that day. It's now 9 p.m., and any hope of sleep decreases with every caffeine intake. Not that sleep has been forthcoming this past week. He flips through the latest ultrasound photos, the real ones, not the ones he and his team have been giving the couple. Jeremiah thinks about how happy the couple was when he showed them the photo of their twins. The man almost bolted from his seat in excitement.
Of course, it would excite them,
Jeremiah thinks. The initial credit check had shown the couple was north of $40,000 in debt for fertility treatment. When Jeremiah had told them that they were accepted as candidates for this new treatment and that it would be free, and that the two would be getting paid for it, the couple's smiles could have lit up the dank office room Jeremiah now finds himself in. Jeremiah can't deny his elation when the insemination worked. Despite what he told the two, this process was far from guaranteed success. And without the expedition and funding from the government, it wouldn't have happened at all without people going to jail. And it had all started with such promise. Hell, the initial scans and tests verified all their theories. Gestation was speeding up, and for a brief period, it was twins. Now, however...
1, 2, 3...
Jeremiah says out loud as he counts the pairs of arms in the latest ultrasound photo.
4, 5, 6... Christ.
Jeremiah puts the photos down and puts his hands on his throbbing temple. He feels something fall on his shoulder, causing him to jump from his seat. He spins around to see his boss, Dr. Brown, with a broad smile across his face.
Didn't mean to startle you there, Jeremiah. Burning the midnight oil, I see.
Jeremiah watches as Dr. Brown's eyes drift toward the photos on the desk. Dr. Brown picks one up, analyzes it, and blows a sharp whistle.
Ooh, boy. I told you if we used more than one type of animal DNA, outcomes would improve. Splicing with goat DNA alone could never have gotten us this.
Dr. Brown says with a grimace that causes Jeremiah to avert his gaze.
The goal was twins. Goats typically have twins, and that's what we promised them. That's what we promised all the government bodies as well.
You're right, we did. And the Chinese government told us when they gave us that $50 million contract that twins weren't good enough.
Why this way, then? Why didn't we use another mammal's DNA, like a pig or something? Working out how to crossbreed with an egg-laying creature took us forever.
Because I am the lead on this project. My research wasn't on pig fertility, and I don't trust that to give us the results we need.
Yes, but...
It's like this, son. China overcounted their population by 100 million not that long ago. They don't have the workers they need. That country could be in a worse economic depression. Good old USA is much better. We can't take in enough people to drive the economic growth that we once had.
Jeremiah recognizes this speech. It's the same one Dr. Brown gave Jeremiah's team when he told them they were using different animal DNA, ignoring all the protests.
Pundits will try to spin the economic downturn most of the world is facing on other causes, but it's down to one reason. No one is around to replace the people retiring or dying. The world needs more kids, and they need them now. Do you know what happens to a civilization that doesn't have kids? It dies. So what are we to do, Jeremiah? What are we as a civilization supposed to do? Let our world collapse because people want to live childless, selfish lives? I refuse to accept that. And I know you do too. We are creating a world where the new norm will have the average birth be 5 or more children.
Jeremiah curses his boss in his head. His arrogance and desire to play God should have gotten him fired, not promoted to head of this project. He hardly listens as Dr. Brown continues to speak.
Besides, don't you like a challenge? If this doesn't work, there'll always be the next time. Plenty of desperate people hoping for kids and desperate government funding us now.
But sir, these images are not just the amount but the form. It's too big for this woman. It's stretching to other parts.
Dr. Brown's smile doesn't leave when he interrupts.
The most a person has naturally given birth to is 12 babies. 12. All we're asking for is 6 to 7. She'll be fine. She'll have to be.
Jeremiah continues.
Part of the child, the thing that's growing inside of her, it looks like parts are leaking out. If we want the woman to survive, we'll have to cut it out.
Dr. Brown's smile disappears.
We will not risk this child. Go home, Jeremiah. I will not have any more talk of this. What is done, and you should be proud of your work. I'm sure your wife is proud of the bank account you have accumulated from working on this.
Dr. Brown turns and walks away.
What about her husband? What will you tell him?
Dr. Brown doesn't stop walking when he says,
we will do what we must.
Then he's out the front door.
What have we done?
The idea of going to the news is there, but Jeremiah can't see himself doing it. Government officials and agencies have been involved in this project, ensuring no information leaks. If Jeremiah becomes a whistleblower, his cause of death will read suicide via 2 bullets in the back of the head. He sits back down at his desk. The smell of coffee turns his stomach into a war zone. He looks at the images. They told her another month, but this thing won't wait that long. She'll be lucky if it's a week. And when it comes out? May 27th, 2035. 10:35 a.m. to 10:48 a.m. Abigail watches as the not-a-doctor leaves the room and gets replaced by 2 people in hazmat suits. She screams as fresh pain explodes from her center like a cramp with no end, making its way through her stomach and back. She tries to curl up and reach towards the pain, but she can't. She can only flail her feet.
Mrs. Ower, I'm Dr. Weissman. I will be delivering your children today.
A man's voice comes from the taller of the hazmats. Sweat pours from Abigail's forehead into her eyes, clouding her vision and darkening her surroundings. The 2 hazmat suits look like they're shaking in a room with no lights. I am going crazy, she thinks as a stabbing sensation erupts near her heart.
Supposed to be a month away. Doctor said,
she says through gritted teeth.
The table has moved up. You'll have your children by the end of the day.
The hazmat suit doctor says. The shorter hazmat has rolled in a familiar-looking machine, an ultrasound.
Epidural. Please, Please.
Abigail asks in gaspy breaths. Another explosion in her stomach, as though tiny razors are shredding her abdomen.
First, we have to check the child. Make sure there's no possibility it will interfere.
Please, stop the pain.
She mutters as she arches her back, but the hazmat doctor either doesn't hear or ignores her. The shorter one approaches Abigail with a white paddle, jelly gleaming off it. He puts it on her stomach. The second the paddle touches Abigail's skin, she sees her stomach swell above her belly button in a misshapen rectangle, like something is trying to touch back. Both the doctor and the assistant reel back, which sends a chill down Abigail's spine, distinct from the pain.
What's happening to me?
She cries out. Both hazmats look at each other but don't respond. The heart rate monitor is racing. The shorter one approaches her again, placing the ultrasound wand on her stomach. This time, her stomach doesn't protrude, but a pain unlike anything she has ever felt roars from her uterus down to between her legs. She thinks, no, she knows, she can hear a tearing sound on the inside of her. She is about to scream, "Get this thing out of me!" What stops her is the stabbing pain in her heart, which has jumped into her throat. Something sticking to the sides and moving upwards, blocking the air from coming through.
Help!
She says, but it comes out as a squeak. The hazmats ignore her again as their attention is drawn to the screen. Abigail turns her head to the left to see what is taking their attention. Despite the burning and tearing in her stomach, despite the thing creeping its way through her neck, causing her breath to wheeze, it is the image on the ultrasound that makes her realize how much of a fool she was to have trusted this process. All the other ultrasounds showed two babies, one's head above the other. Abigail and Tom would name the boy Michael and the girl Robin. What was on the screen now deserved no name. A whirling ball of gray, Abigail, through her clouded vision, can see long arms protruding out. She can make out seven blurry circles with a swirl of thin, black and white lines moving around and up. Each time she sees those gray lines push up, her stomach explodes.
That's enough.
The shorter hazmat retracts the wand.
I'll need some time to converse with my superiors.
What?
Abigail asks, finding enough air to push out the words.
Don't leave me!
The two walk towards a phone next to the door they entered. The hazmat doctor takes off his helmet and picks up the phone. Abigail can't see the man's face, only the shine of his silver hair. She can't hear anything either. The man is talking in hushed tones. After a moment, the man puts down the phone and both leave.
Wait! Don't leave me! Please don't!
She can't finish her sentence as pain ruptures, now from her mouth to between her legs. She throws her head back, smashing it on the steel table, making an already dizzy world turn fuzzy. She tries to look back and see what is happening in her stomach, but can't. Something is protruding out of her mouth, making her jaw open as far as it can and craning her neck back. A brief image of her lower jaw snapping off plays in her mind. Her sight gets forced upwards towards the ceiling. A thing enters the space between her eyes. First small, then closer, she can see it more clearly. A thin, long tube that sways like a twig swaying in the wind. It's the same color as her skin and almost looks like an elongated finger. It drips a liquid that stings as it mixes in with the tears and sweat. A pungent, sour taste coincides with the feeling of her jaw detaching from its hinges. The only thing distracting her from that pain is the ripping in her gut. At first, she thinks the doctor has returned, changed his mind, and is now performing an anesthetic-free C-section. But no, this ripping in her stomach isn't that of a skilled hand. It is the chaotic biting away, the tearing of her flesh. Wetness pools at her waist as something cuts through her abdomen and juts out of her. The liquid pours onto the floor, echoing in the empty room. She thrashes her back upwards, trying to shake off whatever is coming from her. She can't see it, but there's a weight on top of her, not inside her anymore, but sitting on top of her. The table shakes with her movement, craning to each side till it tilts to her right, and both Abigail and the table slam onto the floor. She stares into the one-way glass, seeing her reflection. She closes her eyes, unable to believe what is coming from her. Convinced she has died, and the images that are appearing are that of some final dream, or her first day in hell. That's it, she thinks about her last coherent thought. That must be it. I'm in hell. Why is it so cold then? She keeps her eyes closed and lets the cold wash over. May 27th, 2035, 10:45 a.m. to 10:52 a.m.
Let me go!
Jeremiah hears the woman's husband scream as the guards drag him away and out the door.
What did you bastards do to my wife?
He continues in the hallway. Dr. Brown closes the door once the guards have left. Jeremiah returns his gaze to the woman, who is arching her back and giving birth in a way that reminds him of an old movie where an alien tears through some unexpected person's chest. The bottom of the woman's stomach has ripped open in jagged cuts that drench her torn gown and surroundings in pools of blood. Two beige tentacles pour out from the, if she's lucky, fatal wound. The thing that had, up until now, only been a black and white photo pokes through the tear below her stomach like a jack-in-the-box. It's not one head poking out, however. There are seven heads crammed against each other on a single body. The body has the shape of a warped light bulb. Slime gleams in patches of its peach-colored skin that aren't covered in blood. It's flaked with hair, a sign of the goat DNA at work. Jeremiah was hoping that the goat DNA would prove a counterbalance, but that's not what's coming out. It is pushing and biting through, widening the hole in the woman, but its body is too big or unwieldy to get through fully. It's stuck in the crevices of the woman's wound. The woman's screams get cut off by the tentacle protruding from her mouth. The thing's lipless mouths crow open. With the microphones attached to the room, everyone can hear the child. Children? Let out a screech mixed with a cry that sounds like metal scraping. Jeremiah doesn't think about the fact that the tentacle out of her mouth means the baby has ruptured through her uterus and moved into her esophagus. Instead, he thinks,
please, God, let her not see this. She can hear and feel it. But please, God, let her not see this.
Then the woman clatters to the floor, wrists attached to the table. Jeremiah looks around. Many of the scientists brought in to observe and collect the data are staring at their monitors, avoiding looking. Everyone except for Dr. Brown. He stands there, watching like a professor watches their students take an exam. And is that the creep of a smile on his face?
Son of a bitch.
He thinks.
You son of a bitch.
I can't do this.
One of the doctors at the desk says, stands up and makes his way to the door. He's stopped by the re-entrance of a security guard, who is at least twice his size and holsters a gun that was not there last week.
Calm down, Dr. Grossman.
Dr. Brown puts a hand on the troubled doctor's shoulder and leads him back to his chair.
Sacrifice builds science. Do I have to remind you of Marie Curie and her work? She saved countless lives, yet she died from her research. What we are doing is of a thousandfold more importance.
Dr. Brown straightens his back, squares his shoulders, and projects his most sincere and authoritative voice.
We are saving our civilization.
With that, he turns back to the creep show unfolding. The table scraping against the floor draws Jeremiah's attention back. The world gets a little blurry when he sees what is happening. the child is moving closer to the mirror, pulling the mother along with it as though wanting to see its reflection. The tentacles coming from the stomach look as though they are stuck between the woman's body and its own mass, sticking out of the wound like little fingers. The tentacles at opposite ends of the woman are doing the movement. The tentacle from her mouth comes out as though she were vomiting it up, yet it refuses to leave. It thrashes out at least a foot and pulls her top half, the woman's head banging against the floor as it moves. Jeremiah can see dark blood around her jaw. The tentacle protruding from between her legs moves her bottom half through a separate pile of blood and viscera, parting the bottom of the soiled gown. The arms make a thunk sound, followed by the table scratching along the floor. It pulls itself closer and closer. Jeremiah can see the eyes of some of the heads closest to him looking around. They're glassy, oval in shape and without color, upon blood-stained skin with a pinkish tint. The heart rate monitor disconnects from the woman. A flat line now replaces the frantic beeping of the machine, which unfortunately does not symbolize death. The child wails, all the mouths opening to release the cry at once, revealing jagged razor teeth. Jeremiah feels vomit emerge from his stomach and swallows it.
"How do we get it out?"
he asks, more to himself than anyone.
"We can't right now. We must monitor. Don't you see what we've done?"
Looking around the room, he says,
"We've created a being with 7 consciousnesses. All we have to do now is figure out how to separate the bodies from the next host. My research in octopus fertility DNA was the trick, I told you. They have so many children. If we can get that into live birth, we will have saved the world."
His voice is ecstatic, filled with energy, as though he has been told he is envisioning his future scholarly acclamations. Inside, Jeremiah's thoughts scream.
"What have we done? Please be dead. What have I done? Please, God, let her have bled out. Please, God. Please."
The child's screech is replaced by the woman's ghoulish, muffled scream. Jeremiah takes his hands away from his face to stare into the woman's eyes. Now, he is close enough to the window to see the full extent of what is coming out of her. At this point, Jeremiah faints. June 10th, 2035, 8:05 p.m. Jeremiah sits in his home office, crushing 5 prescription sleeping pills with his teeth before taking a long swig of whiskey. His phone on the desk buzzes. His wife. "The kids and I are here. Are you okay? Are you safe?" He replies before the pills can take effect.
"Yes. I love you all."
He takes out the SIM card and crushes it under his heel. Then he deletes the messages and crushes the phone the same way. They are at his sister's in Boston. Maybe it's too much of a precaution, but he can't risk their safety. There are rumors at the office that one of the doctors who protested at the post-experiment conference has gone missing. Dr. Jones or James, Jeremiah doesn't remember. He does remember when Dr. Jones or James called Dr. Brown the 21st century version of Nazi scientist Mengele. That had turned Dr. Brown's face sour. All the money he has saved from this hell, all $2.2 million, is with his family. He has told them he'd meet them there soon. A necessary lie. He doesn't deserve to see them. He swallows another 4 pills and takes another drink. His head is floating. He thinks about that money and his plans to retire at age 40, win a Nobel Prize for his contributions to biology and medical science, and let the textbooks write about his heroic solving of what has come to be known as the Great Fertility Depression. How worthless that fantasy has become.
"Then why don't you try and stop them?"
A voice he cannot answer asks. He swallows another 2 pills. His handle of whiskey is 3/4 done. He looks at his computer, and the screen sways left and right as messages start appearing. Messages from various news agencies where he has sent photographs, document evidence, and even a video. Would they believe what their eyes were showing them, or would they think it was the doings of some visual effects genius? That such creatures could exist for television and nowhere else? Perhaps. But some of them, some of the more lowbrow news websites, would believe. Once people started researching who the information came from, however, seeing his accredited work, more would believe that he wasn't some nobody wacko, and that would at least halt this company's efforts to try again, for a while. It's hot where he is. He stands up to open the window but finds his legs turned to rubber. He slips and falls, having neither the will nor the ability to get to his feet. Everything is getting dark now, and he's tired. It's time to go into the black, to wipe his mind from the world. His only regret is that he could not take that bastard Dr. Brown with him. No, that's not true. He also regrets not having the courage to put Abigail out of her misery. Even now, as he drifts off into nothingness, he swears he can hear Abigail and her child scream, intertwined and forced together, dragging along a padded room, hooked up to all sorts of machines feeding her and the child. Dr. Brown is not letting either die due to emergency research purposes. He closes his eyes and drifts off with those screams ringing in his ears.
I hope you enjoyed Are You Expecting? As written by Matthew Harrison and performed by Justine Anastasia, Kevin Barberi, Nick Goroff, Jeff Sturtevant, and Eric Peabody. On to the shows. Longtime resident Otis Gyrie has his very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out the Fear from the Heartland archives, featuring more than 120 episodes. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us also on Facebook, X, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the light and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.
Moro Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.